Well, now that I've told that I can't disappoint you, no pressure. I'd like to welcome you. We're all very excited to have you. And in addition to that role, my job is to try and corral those crazy people in the back who are going to be the instructor pool. And as I discovered last night, you guys are in trouble. They're a sick, twisted group. But it's great to have you. We've been looking forward to this. So my job is to sort of set a tone, is to sort of think of, give you some large concepts to think about. And if you'll excuse me a minute, I'm going to adjust the lighting here so you can actually read this.
One of those.
A little better? Everyone over here, don't worry, I'll mime what they say. It's a sock puppet presentation. So I want to talk today about participation in leadership. The State Library has been running programs teaching leadership for a long time, and there was a definite shift in this IMLS grant to bring in technology, and participatory technologies in particular. And I think they're really interesting and joined concepts. And so one of the things that I want to talk about is how adopting participatory technologies and tools leads to an opportunity for greater leadership and commitment and partnership with community. So with that, I'm going to start with the consultant parable. So the consultant parable starts with a consultant in the middle of, you know, a board or a management meeting who looks up, declares loudly that technology is the answer, and then shyly leans to the person next to them and going, now what was the question? Right? So I would just like to give you a quick list. I know not everyone likes this, but to sort of pull the veil and see the life of a presenter in the process, because I know that's really interesting to everyone. These are the presentations I thought about but will not be given today. So we will not be giving the blogs are the future presentation. You know this one, right? You must blog. Why? Because blogs are the future. Williams, the consultant, once put a great thing. She goes, there's lots of different visions of the future. One is it's sort of totally different than where we are. One is it's exactly the same but wearing stretchy lycra. And so I don't actually want to have a future conversation here because, you know, the idea is that we create our own future. And to do that, we need to engage now and not wait for something to happen to us. So it's not going to be one of those. This is the other presentation I refuse to give in my life. The millennials are weird alien spawn with chips in their head, right? The idea that as librarians, you have to come here because there are these strange creatures who are teenagers, which are strange creatures, but they somehow magically come out of the womb knowing technology, right? And this gets translated in lots of different ways. Oh, the millennials have different needs and different requirements. Well, yeah, you know, I go back to Socrates talking about kids these days don't know how to sit at the foot of a philosopher anymore, that reading's going to destroy things. Generational difference may exist. What I'm worried about, though, just as a side note, is within the profession, we buy into this in certain different ways. For example, how many of you have been in the situation of either being or hiring the young librarian? Right? Now, the young librarian is regardless of age. They could be 90 and on oxygen and coming in with a walker, but they just got their MLS net last year, so clearly they know everything about technology. Now, my job is to prepare them, and I could just tell you that that's a lie straight out. So what we do is we take sort of innovation, we build it into our hiring process. Oh, new stuff out there, quick, hire someone to deal with it. And we take the most important activity that a library can engage in, which is innovation and new and change, and we put it in the person's hands with the least experience, the least political capital, and say, good luck! Not a good idea. Here's how we do it good. This is a classic in the library field. This is where I spend 3 hours going through pictures of how we did it, with no idea if anyone else can do it this way. The thousand, plant 1,000 seeds, hope 1,000 bloom, and then deal with it then. Fear and loathing in library land. This will not be a fear and loathing in library land. Oh my God, we're irrelevant. Google's going to put us out of business. Amazon's going to put us out of business. Steve Jobs announced the iPad and we're doomed. You know, this, no, we're not going there. Or my favorite, the Facebook or else presentation. This is where if you don't have a Facebook page, not only can you not hang out with the cool kids, but all the cool kids leave you alone. Now, what's interesting, anyone ever heard the phrase creepy treehouse? This is one of my favorite phrases. You got to use this one regularly. Creepy treehouse comes from the idea that a father builds his children a wonderful treehouse and is so engaged and loves it so much that he never leaves it. And so it's a little creepy for the kids to play there when their father's always there. You know, and so when I look at teen services, it's like, oh, we got to be on Facebook because God knows what teenagers want on Facebook are librarians hanging around seeing what they're doing. Right. Now, there's a theme here which we're not going to follow, and that's the idea that we're going to have a tool conversation. And I understand the idea of technology and tools. Part of why you're here, part of why you put this together is technology and the idea of learning those tools. And in fact, for some of you, that may be the big stress. You know, some of you may have it, but some of you may be coming going, I don't know if I'm going to be able to do this technology. But I just want to give you a little perspective, because learning technology is hard, but knowing when to use it and not use it is harder. And so I want to talk a little bit about that. So what we know is that blogs and wikis and Twitter, oh my, are just tools, just like public access computers before them, and just like the collection has always been, that collections and books and resources and computers and all these types of technology are simply tools to let us get to an end. They are not the end in and of themselves. It all comes down to which technology should we use, comes down to the mission. What is the mission that we're set out to do? That mission must come from deep understandings. That mission cannot be a question, no, I love the ringtone, that's brilliant. That mission cannot be something like, oh, we want to make everyone happy. Or, oh, we've got a bunch of stuff behind us, let's share that. Right? The mission must be more about, more than what we do. It should be why we do it. If we don't understand that mission, if we don't understand why we're blogging and wikiing and content management systems and all these other kinds of things, then we shouldn't take the time to do it. And we shouldn't take the time to do things like cataloging and reference unless we understand why we're doing them. Sometimes our fields become so fixated in what we do that we forgot that there's a why behind that question. And so what I'd like to do is spend a little bit of time today talking about whys. So this is the I Lead You press release out there, and one of the key terms is that you guys are going to work on participatory Web 2.0 technologies. All right? So we've already talked about the sort of Web 2.0 side of that. That's tools. And tools are important, and we're going to spend time learning the tools. I'd like to spend a lot more time on the first part of that phrase, participatory. What does it mean? So here's the Oxford English Dictionary as read by the Apple built-in dictionary on what is participation. To take part. So they're all different kinds of participation. We can look at the idea of technologies, right? So here's what I want to do. Here's our agenda today. We're going to look at how technology allows broader participation. Now, I want you to be really – let me clarify my terms here. Technology is a very general term to me, and it's always been used to extend our capabilities from, you know, broad lifting up the – femur bone to smash things and sticks to get into termite camps, to technology being computers that have allowed us to process things and satellites that allow us to talk around the world, etc. So technology is defined as things outside of ourselves that we use to extend our reach. So technology allows broader participation, right? Once we had indoor plumbing, more people could hang out in our places pleasantly, right? So we're going to talk about that. Now, we're going to look at it certainly a specific type of technology, which is networking computer technology, but stick with me for a minute. So if technology allows broader participation, what is the implication of that? Well, the first is that participation is, by its definition, a two-way conversation. You cannot participate with yourself. In Georgia, particularly not, but here, definitely not. You cannot participate. That was for you guys. You cannot participate. It's a two-way thing. You've got to have someone who agrees, someone to talk with, someone to respond to, a group to be a part of. That two-way nature of participation means that you have a very important role as librarians. And as we're going to talk about, a role that is very different than how we've classically defined it. And that your role is to both listen and to lead. That when you look at participation, when you look at groups working together, it's not simply a matter of sitting back and waiting. You must often prompt participation. You must often be proactive in that system. And ultimately, of course, by being leaders and listening, you're going to then lead to broader participation. All right? So what I want to do is sort of walk you through this circle in the time we have allotted to talk about it. All right? So we will begin with the notion of participation. So that graphic that no one can see, particularly you guys, is of a barn raising, right? So there's all kinds of participation. Barn raising is the classic one. It's the metaphor that we've adopted within corporate cultures. Let's get together and build a barn. So a community member recognizes a need. The community comes together. They put up a barn, life is happy, and people make Witness the movie, and Harrison Ford has a job. But the notion here is that there's all kinds of participation. We can participate in different groups, we can flash mobs, we can do all these things. What we're concerned with in library land as we begin to look and define what is that mission that we're trying to fulfill is we're involved with a very particular type of participation, which is around learning. So now I want you to take a moment and say, well, wait, Dave, learning and participation aren't necessarily the same thing, right? Because I learn all the time, and I don't have to do it in a flash mob. Well, there's a really interesting fellow. He's dead, so I guess he was interesting. Gordon Pask in England, and he came up with, he wanted to teach machines how to think, right? He thought, well, what I'll do is instead of worrying about starting with artificial intelligence, I'll start with natural intelligence until it catches up. And so he looked at how people learn and learning theory. And he said, all right, how do people learn? And what he came across was a relatively simple seeming concept, which is people learn through conversation. Now, that conversation can be between two individuals, between two groups. It can be between two organizations. When you sit down to negotiate that next vendor agreement where they say exactly how much money they're going to rip off, when you go and have that, that's a participatory, that's a conversation. Right? Now, if you can go up, institutions can have it, countries can have conversations. You can go down too. And if you've ever been involved in information literacy instruction, you may have run across phrases like metacognition or critical thinking skills, and the idea that you, in essence, talk to yourself. Right? We tend not to let patrons do that in front of the reference desk, but we talk to ourselves all the time. If you just sat there and said, what the hell is he talking about? Who were you talking to? Right? This is, by the way, how reading works. You are not having a conversation with the book. The book is dead trees. It tends not to have a very rich vocabulary. You're not having a conversation with the author. If you're trying to figure out what Hamlet's motivation is, William Shakespeare is not standing by to give you that answer. So what are you having the conversation with? You're having a conversation with yourself. Do I believe this? Do I think this is good? Do I remember this? Does that stand out? How does this relate to my other experiences? So we have this notion of conversation. It's a very specific type of participation, but it's unique to learning. And I want to be really clear here that reading and learning, you learn from all different things. You learn textbooks, you learn subjects. You take a technical manual, learn tool. You may read Catcher in the Rye to learn about yourself and your perspective and your place in the world. Recreation is a form of learning because we learn what it is that makes us human, what it is that makes us happy, what it is that brings us to other people. All right, so it turns out that all this learning is done with conversation. So we're going to spend a little time now talking about that defining participation in the participatory technology, coming up with our mission around conversations. And conversations seem like really simple things. Right? So you've got time. Over time, a person or a part of an individual or an organization, but we'll just deal with people here, will interact with another person in a series of sequential back and forths. Pretty darn simple. And so we have this back and forth translation. Hey, how are you doing? I'm doing fine. What are you doing today? I'm going to ILEQ. Really? How's that? I don't know. All right. Right? That back and forth. But let's break it down a little bit further and see how this turns into learning. For example, what do we mean back and forth? I mean, are we literally having people wave? What's going on? Well, what's being exchanged in those back and forth is language. People are talking to each other. Even this is a form of language. We know that, for example, musicians talk to each other often through musical notes. Gee, try this, right? We know that many craftsmen have a conversation around actually manipulating objects. So there's all kinds of language going both back and forth. By the way, there's sort of two levels of language. There's a low-level language, which is for people who don't know what they're talking about, right? So we're all sort of, well, I'm in that world a lot. But the idea that when someone walks up and they, you know, we deal with this at the reference desk all the time, right? People ask horrible reference questions. Well, people do the best they can asking for something that they have no clue about. This is, by the way, why every commercial ASCA service has fallen flat on its face, right? The, I'll charge you $5 to ask a hard question, $10 for a really hard question. No one can define what a hard question is or a really hard question. If anyone said at the reference desk, you know that someone's come up and asked an easy question that's taken you 12 hours to figure out. Right? My favorite story, I heard one librarian say, their favorite story was they had a fourth grader who was given an assignment to come up with sort of the habits of animals. And one of the questions they needed to know was, what's the sleep cycle of this animal? And they chose a clam. And so they walked up to a librarian and they said, do clams sleep? So this woman embarked on like a year-long odyssey, you know, talking to marine biologists and, you know, the Oceanographic Institute, and they sort of came with, well, they get quieter at times, you know, so you get this language, the basic language is, I don't know, right? And the reference interview usually starts that. It's very directional, right? That reference interview is all about trying to figure out common ground, where either the person asking the question doesn't know anything, right? Like, I've been told to learn about this. How do I do that? And sometimes the librarian matches that, you know? And sometimes the person knows a lot. Gee, I need to know particularly, you know, in the fourth quarter profit cycle of this corporation in Japan, I need to, right? They know a lot enough to ask that question. And the librarian's the one that, in essence, is directional. Well, would they be in the stock exchange? Would they be these things? So it's a negotiation, right? Then there's a higher level order, which is as you learn something, you move to language that's really about things, the why questions, right? And so the whole idea of education is as you move through a formal education system, you sort of start with low-level language and move your way up to this high-level language, all right? Now, what's going on? Why are they bothered sitting here exchanging language back and forth? What are they negotiating? What are they trying to do? Well, what they're trying to do is reach agreements that bubble up from this conversation. Things like, does that make sense? All right, can we agree that this is a Japanese company? Right, the questions that people ask, something like, I'm looking for an article, and it was about 6 months ago in the Wall Street Journal. Are you sure it was the Wall Street Journal? It might have been the Wall Street Journal, might have been something else. Right? You came to an agreement, which is, I have no clue, and this is about to be a pain. Right? So we come to these agreements, and the most important agreement that we can come to is we agree not to agree. Now, we have to at some point say, look, we're just not going to solve this today. Let's move on, or let's stop. So there are all these types of agreements, and I want to be really clear. Those are not facts. They're beliefs. They're beliefs that people act upon. Things like it's cold outside is a belief. Things like it's been a hard winter. I mean, what's hilarious is it's been a hard winter in Syracuse versus it's been a hard winter in Baltimore this year are very different beliefs. At one point, Baltimore had more snow than Syracuse, 70-some inches. And I just thought, oh, my God, I thought I had it bad. Right? All right, so these agreements. Now, the other important thing about these agreements, so these conversants, these people, are going back and forth with language to seek agreements. And the other important thing to know, and we'll get to this in a second, is those agreements don't just sit there as little idle pieces of information out there. They sit in relation to each other. They make sense to each other, right? So, for example, knowing that Mount Everest is this high is one agreement. Knowing that your plane flies this high is another agreement. Knowing that this plane is going to try and fly over this plane, that relationship is important, right? This talks a lot about library practice because a lot of what we try and do is try to create these little separate categories. And those combinations, those relationships are unique to an individual. My relationship about ideas and terms are very different than your relationships. And so this is why we lead to the classic hard problems of why do catalogs suck, right? Now, what's interesting, if you look at evaluation data of library catalogs and you ask you guys, how good the library catalogs are, your answer will be, I don't like it, but I'm really good at it, right? I mean, when you look at performance of finding materials, using materials, you guys rock the catalog. And you look at a patron, and it's like they might as well have just been dead and dragged in and thrown on the keyboard with how effective they are. Why? Because you understand the language and the relationships represented by the system. They have no clue, right? And so what do? Do we change the system? No. We'll teach them. We'll make them like us. Now, so this is what's going on. Now, I want to talk about a few things, because if this is how people are learning, what is it that librarians can do to facilitate this process? Which is, this is a very individual process. Why bother us with it? Well, the answer is you need certain conditions to make that learning occur. For example, you need access to conversations. Right? Think of these in the digital divide debate. There was the whole idea about, you know, people in urban centers aren't going to have the same economic capabilities because they don't have access to the technology and the internet. So the first thing they had to do was get them access to it. So if we're going to learn through conversation, the first way we facilitate that is getting someone to the conversation or getting someone artifacts of the conversation, right? But we know that 90% of librarianship has been focused on this access question, but it's insufficient. So I have a 6.5-year-old son. And when he was reading, he's struggling a little bit when he was, you know, kindergarten, starting the reading thing. Walking him into the public library and leaving him there for 2 weeks, while tempting, is insufficient to teach him to read. Access is insufficient to learn. It's important, it's vital, but insufficient. All right? So just because we have beautiful collections that we can find stuff in doesn't mean anyone's going to learn from them. So what else do we need? Well, we need baseline knowledge. Once you get to the conversation, what do you need to know? So how many people, and I love this because only librarians can answer this question, how many people are on a committee that has existed in one form or another for over 50 years? You don't go to ALA? Yeah? A couple of you? Right? Oh, my God. Right? And you're the new person. And you get on the committee, and there will always be the historian. Right? There's always the historian on the committee. When you come up with the idea and say something like, I think we should have a blog. And the phrase, the deadly phrase, it's just like a conversation killer, starts with, what you need to remember is, in 1932, we tried blogging, and it didn't work. Really, 1932. We used slate tablets. We hung them in front of the library. It rained. All the chalk went away. Right? So it would be nice to come up to speed quickly on 50 years of history so you could look at them and go, yes, but the problem was we were using the wrong chalk. Right? So once you get to a conversation, you need a baseline knowledge, which is this one thing to say, I want to know what's going on in the physics world. It's very another thing to say, I give you access to this online conversation with a physicist. And it's yet a whole other thing to say, I have any clue what a lepton is, right? Or it's a great conversation. It's in French. I don't speak French, right? So we do a lot of instruction, right? Getting on technology, getting to the computer, basic skills to get into that conversation. The next thing we must provide for a conversation, think of this as a third level digital divide, is a safe environment to do it in, which is what that historian was doing in that committee was creating an unsafe environment for you to engage in the conversation, right? By taking your input and somehow minimizing it and putting you at risk whenever you put your ideas, they're quelching conversation, right? So how do we create a safe environment to do that in? Now, we do safety in all different ways. Public libraries are used to physical safety, someplace after school and someplace kids can come where they're not being harassed. We, as a community, have built one of the cornerstones of our value system around intellectual safety. You can look at what you want and no one's going to look over your shoulder. So we create these safe environments. Now, what we need to remember is, why are we doing this? Because I had a situation. It was at a public library. And what happened at the public library, they had a suite of open access terminals, and the police started showing up. Uniformed police started showing up and would stand behind the people working on their public access computers. And the librarians at one point, after a couple of days of this, said, hi, anything going on we should know about? You know, it's, you know, just wondering. And the policeman said, well, we know that there are registered sex offenders that come into the library. And we just want to make sure that they're not going to use this technology to violate any of the conditions of their parole. And the librarians thought about this for a minute because there was a legal right going on here. But they said, this has a freezing effect. We have an unsafe environment. Our patrons, you know, they're like checking Facebook going, just checking Facebook. Look at the New York Times. Oh, my God, there's a breast. Sorry about that. You know. So what the librarians got together, they did is they said, how can we create a safe environment for this situation? So what they did, they put filters on the public access computers. Now, we could say, oh, wait, no, that violates intellectual access and all these other things. But what happened was the librarians then went to the police and said, we've created a condition where the people you're looking at can't violate those conditions. You don't need to be here anymore. And the police said, okay, and they left, and they actually freed up access. Now, it may not have been a perfect situation, but the question of why we're doing something versus this is our policy comes into play. So what's the last thing that we can do to facilitate learning, facilitate conversation? And that's around the idea of motivation. That when people learn, we have to understand why they're seeking to engage in these conversations. Or putting it another way, we can get them to a conversation, we can give them the basic information to participate, we can make them feel safe, but if they are unwilling to engage at that point, it doesn't matter. And so we need to spend a lot of time figuring out why people are coming into our libraries. I would also argue we need to spend a lot more time thinking about ways of making them come into our libraries. And by the way, coming to our libraries can be a virtual question as well. Come to library resources and services wherever they're offered. But I'll leave that one aside for a second. When someone shows up at the desk, we built this whole grand concept around intrinsically motivated people. People who take the time to come, who walk up to the reference desk, who proactively move forward. Do we take time to understand why they've done that? Why are they there? What motivates them? How can they get reward out of this situation? How much time and effort should we spend? So now I want to go back to that idea where I said these agreements are in relationship to each other and the relationships matter. What I've just tried to do is build two specific sort of entailment meshes, two maps. One around the concept of facilitation, that facilitation consists of access, knowledge, environment, and motivation. And one around conversation, that a conversation consists of conversance, language, agreements, and memory. See how they were related? We could go further and say that those two things then lead to this larger concept of knowledge. Knowledge is created through conversation. We can facilitate that process. We could keep going with this and keep scaling and scaling and scaling till we get the whole of librarianship. But that's for another time. What I want to show you quickly, though, is the implications of these ideas, which is if this really is what's going on, what are the implications for our service? Well, the implications of a conversation, first of all, is that a conversation is co-owned. Now, you sit there and think, well, sure, there are two people in the conversation. And that means that the person, the patron, or I call the members of your library, are own that conversation. But so do you. And we're going to see the implications of that just in a little bit, because it means things like unbiased right out the door. Right? Now, I give you a quick example of a co-owned conversation. It's an old joke, but I like it. Woman goes into the greengrocer and says, I'd like a pound of broccoli, please. The greengrocer says, I'm sorry, we're all out of broccoli, but I'd give you a pound of cauliflower. It's really good. Woman said, that would be great. So I'll just take that pound of broccoli. The greengrocer says, I'm sorry, ma'am, we're out of broccoli, but I have some great spinach here. Would you like the spinach? Spinach. I love spinach. I'll just take the pound of broccoli. Greengrocer says, lady, we don't have broccoli. Would you like green beans? No, no, just the broccoli. So finally, he goes, ma'am, can you spell cat as in catastrophic? Well, sure, C-A-T. Can you spell dog as in dogmatic? Oh, yeah, D-O-G. Can you spell stink as in broccoli? There's no stink in broccoli. That's what I'm trying to tell you! Right? So if someone's not willing to listen, if someone's not willing to engage, you can't have a conversation. So conversations are co-owned. But knowledge is not co-owned. There is no such thing as a universal knowledge. When you guys, and when I'm done, and let me be presumptuous and say we've created knowledge, maybe that much, but we've created a little bit of knowledge. When I ask each individual, what did he say? How would you represent that? I would get individual answers. We see this all the time where we're talking to someone and we're so sure we're on the same wavelength, and then suddenly, boom, they watch Fox News and oh my God, right? So this idea that we each have individual representations of the world, right? And how do we deal with those different representations? Conversations, where we begin to work them and come up with these agreements. So knowledge is unique and can never be recorded. The concept of recorded knowledge is an oxymoron, and we need to stop it right now. Those books and DVDs and CDs and web pages you point to are not knowledge. If I take a book written in ancient Sumerian and I drop it in front of you, you cannot learn from that thing other than, well, it's sort of a book. Right? And it's, or it's a scroll, or it's got these kind of characters, but you can't necessarily get what's intended out of it. So when you look at this, and I ask you, are librarians in the knowledge business or are librarians in the recorded knowledge business? What I'm really asking is, are you in the knowledge business or are you doing something that's not even true? Right? So let's take these ideas and go back to that once again, participation mission. Why are we engaging in participatory technology? Why are we engaging in this? We can see from this that the mission of a library, and I'll tell you it's a partial one right now, is to facilitate knowledge creation in our communities, and we also can say that that is a product of facilitation and conversation, right? It, to facilitate things like create a safe environment, provide access, provide baseline knowledge, right? And conversation in this back and forth engagement with themselves, with others, with other groups, with other organizations. But this is not a sufficient mission. This is not a sufficient mission. If you look at the mission statements of your libraries and you see things like, we provide access for the community, it is insufficient. And you're wondering, why is that insufficient, Dave? That's what we do. Well, my answer is Eli Nyberger. Eli Nyberger, him, is the tech librarian at Ann Arbor District Library. And if you ever get a chance to meet, talk with, hear Eli Nyberger, take it. He's really well known in the gaming community in that he's actually built these massive worldwide gaming programs. But the other thing he's done is he's, for example, created production librarians, where librarians spend most of their time out with community members and organizations producing materials to go online. But that's a whole other conversation. Eli Nyberger tells a story that they put on online comment cards. And his favorite comment card, well, I'm not sure if it's his, but it's mine, is what can the library provide to make it better? And the answer was, more pie and prostitutes. Now,
next takeaway.
More pie and prostitutes. And now the answer is, if you want people coming in through the door, we already have adult services. It wouldn't be a big leap. But, you know, and we already have bakeries. All right. And, you know, maybe the Nevada. This is a Nevada conference. But anyway, the idea here is that there are certain things that we're not quite willing to facilitate. You know, there are places that we're not necessarily willing to go to. It's like, I hate the phrase that the customer is always right, because if the customer walks into your store, takes three things off the shelf and walks out the door and says, I don't have to pay for this, and I'm always right. No, they're not. We can try and meet their needs. We should try and meet the needs. But at some point, we must stop and say, wait a minute, we're not going there. When a reporter walks into your library and asks, I need to do a story on how hate groups use the web to recruit new members, and you point them to the Ku Klux Klan website because it's an excellent resource, right? That's good. Eighth grader looking for an after-school program? Not so good, right? This idea that we have limits, we have boundaries. And so if we look at this conversation going back and forth, not only do we have language exchange, but that language, that concept, that understanding the differences in how we think of things leads to a pressure, this pressure for participation. That conversations are about shaping. Now, you know this even from, if you have kids, you know this, right? There's always a pressure for who gets to talk first, right? And wait, I'm talking to your mother now. Wait, no, I'm on the phone. What? Right? That's a pressure, right? But this pressure going constantly back and forth about, if I'm learning, if I'm therefore in a conversation, if you're a learning organization, you're facilitating my conversation, I want to shape that experience. How many of you have been in classes where you walked out and said, I would do that totally different? Or you've been in a learning management system, like, this is the worst interface ever. I would like to. You're trying to shape it. We have a conversation going on right now at Syracuse University around what is the library. The library is 92% stacked full. And they were about to offsite about 20% of that. And the humanities scholars went, excuse me, we like books. And it into this interesting, fabulous debate about what is the library. Where the library was clearly on a track where they were building common spaces, they were doing all the warm, cuddly stuff. They had put in the bakery, they'd done all this, they'd had lots of online resources, and the humanities folks showed up and said, more shelves, more shelves, more shelves, more shelves. See where you're sitting? Get up, shelf. That's where they were. Right? That's a pressure. And it's, in fact, a pressure where now they've had to scale back certain things, move more stacks in different places. There's a pressure going on there. What do you do? How do we do it? What should you look like? But what I want to point is there's pressure on both ends because we need to push right back on that community and say, we can't do that. We should do this. We have data that says this. No, too many stacks makes you a hoarder, and that's a psychological condition, right? We need to go back and forth on that. Now, that comes from our values. Now you say, oh, Dave, no. I read the ALA stuff. I am unbiased. When people come to me, I am but a blank wall to help them communicate. Oh, please. Multiple perspective, multiple sources. When you answer a reference question or answer a question in general, you make sure that you present multiple sides of any given topic that has multiple sides and make sure that multiple sources in. That idea that a richer, multifaceted environment for better decision making is a bias. That means that you have a perspective. Right? And we see it all the time because sometimes we're foisting these on our patrons and they're like happy with the first one, right? The great reference librarian thing, right? You always can tell the great reference librarians because they're the one chasing the patrons out the door. One more thing. One more search. Right? How about peer review and high credibility? When people walk into our doors, do we push them to the fringe literature and like Joe Bob's blog and stuff, or do we look for things in published databases? Bias. Things like print versus electronic. If you get a question in reference and your first task is to do this versus this, you've shown a bias. Collections, how you catalog things. I mean, come on, the idea that Dewey Decimal is somehow a valueless organizational scheme? Hello? Right? I'm a fiery academic from upstate New York. I hope I'm also not a misogynist and anti-Semite, but, you know, the idea is that when you look at the idea that religion is, you know, well, gee, 1 through 99 is all Christian text, and now all the other religions fit here, that's a bias. It shows a perspective, and you can talk about literary warrant all you want. When you catalog things, let me just be super precise. When you catalog things, and I don't care if you're original cataloging or you're copy cataloging and you're picking someone, you show a bias. You show a perspective. When you're copy cataloging and you see 3 copy catalog records on a given book, one of them's from Harvard, one of them's from Fredonia State, and one of them's from like Pisgah, tell me you don't pick one versus the other. That's a bias. English language. Do you serve in other languages? Things like age appropriateness. Do you have a youth collection? Things like community. And by the way, you say, well, age appropriate, that's easy. There are great texts that talk about the notion of childhood as an invention of the middle 20th century. That before that, they were just young adults that couldn't work in the mills yet because their arms were too short. Right? This idea that we create this isolated, sheltered environment for children to develop is a creation. And so the notion of how we shape youth services, is it story time, shows a bias. Here's a classic one. When should story times be in public libraries? Well, they should always be before 11 o'clock. Really? Why? Well, because that's when parents can come. Excuse me? Did you realize that, like, according to the census, the idea that there is one husband, one wife, and the husband works is like 10% of the population? And the notion that any sort of standard husband, wife, and children is only makes up 30% of the families as reported in the census in this country? Right? Why not offer story time at 5:30 at night after they come home? Right? What bias are we showing for these things? Community standards, literary warrant, all my point is that we have bias. But my point is that what makes us a profession is not simply that we know how to facilitate conversations and learning, not simply that we understand how learning occurs, but it is also because we bring our values to this situation. Right? The notion of facilitating conversation, Facebook can very easily stand up and claim that role. They can say that's all we do. Right? AOL, Instant Messenger, could claim that that is their role. Google could claim that is their role. Of course, with Buzz, their role is also to expose your friends and all your friends' friends, whether you like it or not. But the point I'm bringing is that there's a third thing we need. We need to add something else to this mission, that a mission of a librarian is not simply to create knowledge, but there must be something else, and it must be based on our values. Values like intellectually honest, not unbiased. The idea that we don't have biases is not true. The idea that we recognize them, expose them, and work to control them in the needs of the patrons, that's true. The idea that somehow we teach librarians what are good resources and bad resources is ridiculous. It is wrong. We teach them good resources and bad resources for a given situation, context, or question. Notice that context is the emphasis. It's what we can bring that things like Facebook and Google can't. That we have a standard of intellectual freedom and safety. That we believe that not only should you get to what is the mainstream, but you should be able to access all different types of information, right? Think about this, that we provide the whole view, that if you want to read Mein Kampf in your time, we're not going to necessarily ask you why, and you're going to be allowed to do that, right? If you want to read these kinds of materials, we provide the safety for you to explore these ideas. Openness, that we do it in a way that makes open information as much as we can. Now, this is a ideal, and it's all about context, right? So that if you're a librarian working for the Department of Defense where you literally are dealing with classified data, this is not me telling you should go take out a website and post it all. What I'm saying is you push for openness within the community standards. That's the two pressures. The pressure for you to say open, 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 and the pressure for the community saying this needs to be kept safe. And that is a constant and ongoing and should be explicit negotiation that we're having with our communities, an ongoing conversation. And the last value that we bring to it is learning. The notion that what we do is about learning. What we do is about knowledge. It is not about stuff. It is not about warehousing. It is not about artifacts. It is about learning. So now we can look at the mission, and we have a complete mission. The mission of librarians is to The mission of librarians is to improve society through facilitating knowledge creation in their communities. A two-part mission. The second part is the one we focused on. It's access. It's make knowledge, make it open, make it useful. We'll bring in information. It'll happen. But the second part is just as important, which is there is a goal and there is an aim. I would also point out that there's something very special about this mission, which is it is the mission of librarians, not the mission of a library. A library is either a place on an org chart or a building. All it can do is sit and decay, right? It takes people to make things happen. Now, if you say things like, the library's website sucks, you are really sort of excusing the fact that at some point your website sucks. You're abdicating responsibility to some larger, grander, abstract ideal. It is your mission, your time. And improve society. The reason this is so vital, if we all remember the EPA situation where the EPA decides to close a bunch of libraries and librarians sort of have a hue and outcry, they said, it's too important to keep this conversation within this community. We must go outside of it. Right? We have to look at what our individual responsibilities are, because I give you a belief of mine that within 10 to 20 years, the majority of the times of librarians will be spent outside any physical building called a library, outside any organizational boundaries. You'll be working with community groups to facilitate their conversations. You'll be working with communities to find their information, because remember, things like access are two-way. We've always looked at access as providing our community access to other people's stuff. And increasingly, we need to talk about providing our community's information to other people. That's why you're here, right? If you're talking about building a portal for employment or entrepreneurship, you could just link to someone else. But you say, no, there's something unique about the needs of our community that makes it happen that we need to provide it. That means your community has knowledge that you can share with the world. Imagine the day when someone goes to your library not to learn about other places, but to learn about where you live, to learn about the communities and knowledge conversation that you have. And this mission is not about an academic librarian or a public librarian or a school librarian or a special librarian. We keep subdividing the world. I'm an academic. I'm a professor. I know the rule in academia. Take pond, continue to divide until biggest fish within you are, right? I don't just study librarianship, I study reference. I don't just study reference, I study virtual reference. I just study virtual reference. I study virtual reference done on a Commodore on Tuesday afternoon, whatever, and I'm the world's premier expert in it, give me tenure. Right? This reductionist view, we need to get rid of it. We need to realize that librarianship is librarianship, not constantly balkanize and divide our world. And that this mission is not fixed forever. That is one step in an ongoing and rich conversation begun literally thousands of years ago. The old joke, if we're not the oldest profession, we help organize the records of the oldest profession, right? And it's about what it means to be a librarian, what it means now, where are we going, right? And it's conversation, yes. It's facilitation, our role in that process, but it's also the values that we bring to it. So ultimately, the mission we have, yes, is service. Absolutely. The core of what we do, our core value, is service. And I believe that librarians are a noble and vital part of society, and that the future of librarianship is bright, but not if we continually see ourselves as centered and on artifacts and confined to institutional walls and waiting to help. For too long, librarians have seen our highest aim as to stand ready to serve, to offer a hand of assistance to those who reach out. But that's not enough. The world is not changed by those who stand ready. The world is changed by those who act, who shape, who reach, not when asked, but when necessary. Serve, yes, but also be an instrument of radical, positive change, and in the face of ignorance, lead to a better tomorrow. That is the calling that we have. It is not stacking and shelving. It is improving society and communities, that we not only have to serve, but we have to innovate, constantly look for what's new and what's better, have a vision of the future, not simply for your organization or your task or your function, but the whole community. What is going to make Springfield better, Chicago better? What's going to make our communities better? and be engaged in that, whether it happens in the library or not. I had a brilliant student, one of those students that makes, thank God you're a professor that you were able to watch them bloom and take no credit. And she said, I went to this library, she's the adult programming librarian, and she had a square dance event. And there wasn't enough room in the library, so she did it at a partner institution right down the road, which was an ice rink. And she came back, and the other librarians called her and said, what was that? She says, it was a library program on square dancing. I said, no, it wasn't a library program. It wasn't, wait for it, in the library. How about this one? She's also busy doing things like she loans out her dog. So she's barcoded her dog. She calls it barcoding her dog. Right? She's talking about they're on this plot of like 50 acres that is undeveloped. And the developer said, if you can get the money for a backhoe, let's put trails in that people can go cross-country skiing. And she's, by God, going to barcode the trails. And she's going to barcode the community garden that she started. And frankly, if there's anything else she can get a barcode on, she's going to do it. Because the point is not what happens in the facility. The point is what the community learns. This is our passion. Our passion to look at a community and not hide our light and not say it's only what we learned in school. It's looking and saying this is what needs to happen and proactively reach out and making it happen. And so it's not even innovation. It's leadership. We must be prepared to stand up and point to a better tomorrow. We as librarians have a vocation and a calling, not simply a job. When we look at our communities, we are stewards of that community. And you do not serve the community by sitting back and being unbiased and adding no value. You serve the community by standing up and saying what is right and making it happen. So ultimately, what we're here to do over these next months is not simply to blog and to wiki and to Facebook and such. We'll do that. Those are tools that help us. But the reason we're going to do that is so that we can lead, so that we can be prepared to make better communities. That's what we have to worry about every day, every hour that we spend on this project and every other that we spend as librarians. Thank you very much.